podcast was a mess.
Welcome back to the Wildlife Herb Podcast. Today we're going to talk a little bit about managing Bob Whites and doing that on a budget. There's been a lot of chatter lately about Bob White management and things with Bob Whites, and especially how expensive it is. And yes. So all kinds of things.
Yep, gotta love social media to get your blood pumping.
Oh, gosh.
As a real biologist.
Instead of a Google biologist.
Yeah. Armchair.
That's right. So one of the things that we wanted to talk about first is just a quick comment on the eyeworm fiasco, or whatever you want to call it, that's kind of going around the debate.
I guess it comes around every few years. It's already dying out, but...
Yeah. There's still some folks who are focused on eyeworm, and I'm just going to say Georgia... I'm not going to speak for other states, but Georgia does not have it.
In general.
Right. Yeah. Does not have an issue with eyeworm. They've not been really found in previous studies. I've never seen one. Not to say that there's not some bird out there that has an eyeworm, but it's not to a population level issue. And so don't spend your money putting out a medicated feed for something that we don't have a problem for. It's not going to help your populations.
Focus on other habitat. That is not your issue.
Right.
Yeah. And the Southeastern Cooperative Wildlife Disease Study has done stuff in the past as well. So you can look that up.
Yeah. We'll post a paper here at the end in the comments. And if you want to hear some more on some eyeworm and some more information and some comments from other folks, you can look at the... MSU podcast. They did a pretty good job of that. I'm not going to mention the one that started it because I don't want everybody getting wound up again. But eyeworm, sickle worm, and all those things, that's just something else that's there. If the habitat's in place and you have good quail management, those sorts of things shouldn't be an issue. So let's talk about what is actually needed for quail management or quail habitat to start with, because I think the focus has come off of habitat, and there may be some confusion on what makes up quail habitat. And they're an early successional species. So to define that, basically, it's that habitat that follows some sort of disturbance. Those early stages, low grasses, shrubs,
early forests. Stages of becoming a forest,
right?
Basically,
right. And you can have them in a forest, obviously,
right?
But it's an open forest where you have that ground cover and all of that plant material and grasses and things that they need.
Light hitting the ground.
Right. So lots of sunlight. We consider Bob Whites a shrub obligate, shrubland obligate, meaning that similar to a grassland species, they need those grasses and forests, but they also need the shrub component because of the cover.
That's right. Yeah, it's all about the cover and groceries.
Right. So we'll see a lot of people who... they think they have really good quail habitat. And the comment that I hear so much is, well, nothing's changed. And all of a sudden we don't have birds. And our habitat's the same thing as it was 50 years ago. Or anybody who's ever sat down and looked at Google Earth and go through the, the historical footage there. If you slide that little slider back, you'll see that the landscape has changed. And there may be a few places where that property hasn't changed much, but everything around you most likely has. And we look at a landscape context when we're talking about managing for quail.
Yeah, because even though they, you know, basically live in small areas, it takes a large landscape to sometimes sustain, you know, good populations, especially huntable populations.
Right. And so they got to also have their needs met for all year round.
Yes, and that is often what is missing.
Yep.
As you look out there, and what's always missing is cover. You know, that winter cover.
Yep. Or a winter food source.
Yep.
Maybe that's lacking in some way. Sometimes it's brood cover that's lacking. But there's usually one component that's missing. And if you don't have all those components, you're not going to have a healthy population.
Yeah. You know, as I drove out this morning to bring the kids to school, I was thinking, because, you know, we're like, our brains never stop for this stuff. And, you know, we haven't heard quite as many birds around us lately because we have new farmers leasing. So they're doing things a little bit differently. And I was looking out all the frost on the ground, and all the landowners I talked to was like, well, we have really mild winters. It shouldn't be that big of a deal. But these nights where we have it down to the 20s and teens in a row, frost is on the ground, there is no good thermal cover for them unless they go into the damp woods
Yeah.
at night. You know, and I was looking at that around, you know, some farms near us. And even on our place right now, because of we were too late planting some stuff, the frost and everything can just be too much.
Yeah, you mentioned in, you know, them going into those wet bottomlands, and that's another thing that we've done is we've created good habitat for the predators when we've reduced habitat for quail. So those bottomland areas look like safe spaces for quail. They're nice and dark and dense, so they'll go into those areas, but that's the predator
Yeah,
habitat.
everybody else is in there too.
Yeah. So they go in there and they get eaten. So we don't want them going into that those areas. Not saying that they don't utilize them, even if you have good habitat, because quail don't read the manual.
I mean, how many times have you dragged me out hunting and we end up in the dense woods and I'm like, there's no way. And sure enough,
Yep, there's
dogs
always a
are
covey.
pointing. Yeah.
Yeah, so you know they use a variety of habitats, but we want to reduce the poor areas and those areas that are good predator habitat, and give them an opportunity to survive because quail are good at dying. They're the low man on the totem or the chain, food chain, and
Everything wants to eat them.
everything eats quail whites. That's just why they try to reproduce so many times during the year, getting a lot of little babies on the ground. Because everything's going to eat them. So we want to reduce that opportunity they have to die, reduce their movement, because the more they move, the more likely they are to be seen by predators. And again, they're going to die.
Right. And one of the things we often do when we have, you know, students out or we're training someone is to get down on the ground and look at the ground from a quail's view and also from like a chick's view and thinking how little those chicks are and the cover that's required. And kind of doing that gives you a whole new outlook on things about things that haven't changed.
Right. We were in an area recently where the past years we had found several coveys. And this year we haven't found those birds. And we're like, well, what's going on? Because it still looks good. And when I start, you know, get into the biologist mindset, start really looking, the grass component, even though they're native bunch grasses, they're really thick in there this year. And I got to noticing it's really hard for me to walk through here. So if it's hard for me to move through these grasses and I'm not seeing a lot of spacing in there, then it's
No
most
bare
likely,
ground.
right, you don't have that bare ground. And that term aggravates me a little bit.
Sorry, I know.
I don't know if we'll define it. So bare ground is not necessarily just wide open dirt. It's that spacing in between the plants,
Between the bunch grasses and
right, and
the
that overhead
thicker.
cover so that they can move around. So it's bare spaces in
Yeah, it's
between.
not necessarily uncovered ground.
Right, it's not like a plowed field.
Right.
You want grasses over the top of it, or ragweed, or beggarweed, and a variety of
It's
things.
basically like little highways in between the bunches of grass.
And that's why pasture grasses like Bermuda and Bahia aren't good, because there are no spaces between that, and they can't move. You know, if you're the size of a pecan or golf ball, it's really hard to move around in those sort of things, or even the larger birds. So as I'm looking at that, realizing these grasses are really thick. There's nowhere for these birds to be able to move, so they've obviously pushed away from that somewhere. And then we go into another stand, which looks very similar from the roadside, and we're finding birds. And I point out to Travis, it's like, okay, notice what we're seeing differently here, is there's a lot of bare ground, those spaces on the landscape all across through there, and we find two coveys in this one little area because there's food, there's cover, and there's space for them to be able to move around in. And
And that space isn't just important for moving around, it's also important for them flushing
yes,
to get away. So it's
so that was the big difference. And some of it's, you know, timing of burns or the frequency of burns and, the management, and things can change on you really quickly, especially with our growing season.
right. And you don't, I think you take for granted too how much just a timing shift of a month of something you didn't get to when you normally do, it really changes things. And that's what we're seeing in our farm.
Yep.
You know, we didn't like I said, didn't get to some things as soon as we wanted to, and it's just not there.
Yeah.
We're not seeing birds as much this year.
Yeah. And, you know, it's just really interesting. And I do this with, we're doing some lectures with students, and I'll show pictures. And this looks like good habitat for quail, but are there birds there? And those places that we were hunting, we weren't finding birds. If you just drove up, like, this is, wow, this is a great habitat. The dogs would love to run through this area because it's nice and pretty. It's grasses, mm-hmm. you know, it's not a ton of briars and that sort of thing. And we have found birds in the past, but it's gotten a little too overgrown with the grasses at this stage. So you can have too many bunch grasses.
Yep.
You can have too few.
I see that, you know, for a while there we were pushing wiregrass. For restoration, but you know, wiregrass needs some disturbance to break it apart. And on some places that we visited a few years later, it was just so thick, it was solid. A mat. And I mean, wonderful when it's done correctly,
yep.
but this was just planted way too densely. And they ended up having to pull some out and disc stuff. And it was just, it hurt to watch that happen to wiregrass, but too much can be a good thing. And it's not naturally dense.
Yeah.
It's well spaced out just enough for that fire to be able to hop, hop, hop.
Right.
And, you know, we see lots of birds hiding under
wiregrass. Yeah, they will utilize it for hiding. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not done right. It's
just
as bad as the other non-natives.
Yeah, and it's, you know, wiregrass was not meant to be dominant in the landscape. If you go into these areas that are, you know, some of the true natural areas, it's just wiregrass here and there, like you said.
Really sparse.
People get a little carried away. Quail don't really utilize wiregrass.
Yep.
It's just there to carry fire.
Yeah, and it was, you know, a lot was planted in the name of bobwhite or a gopher tortoise.
Yes.
And, you know, it lacks nutrition. I can't imagine it's something that a food preference.
No.
You know, it's probably a desperate food for them, but.
Yeah, it'd be like, you know, white-tailed deer will eat privet, but that's not going to be a preferred food source.
That's right.
So yeah, there's
don't plant privet.
No, please don't.
See, nobody has to. See our episode about invasives and privet. For the record.
Yeah. No, but there, you know, we get these ideas in our head that there's certain things. You know, it was early on. We'll go in. Speaking of invasives, it was the Lespedeza, mm-hmm. the Sericea, the bicolor. All this was the, you know, I've seen people who went crazy planting. Purple top and, you know, those grasses because
love
they use
grass.
Love grass. That's the name I was thinking of. Because it was great for planting pin-reared birds in.
Right.
It's thick.
And they hold.
They hold because they can't go anywhere.
You stick them under there and they'll still be there a few hours later when you have your
unless the Hulk
your
finds
client.
Them.
Yeah.
Then you got to dig them out from underneath it. But that's the same thing with wild birds. They're not going to move through that. And so people get ideas on certain things. And it's the same with habitat, bringing it back around, is we get these ideas and these pictures in our mind of these big quail plantations who spend millions and millions of dollars a year on doing habitat. And so we think the only way we can have quail habitat is to spend this kind of money, and that it's just cost prohibitive. It doesn't have to be that way.
No, and I think what people fail to pay attention to are the goals of those properties and the hunting pressure on those properties and how many people they're having to satisfy throughout the year. And normally on an everyday piece of property, you are not going to get to those numbers.
No.
And if you are, it could actually have bad effects on your populations because your densities of quail are too high to be healthy. And it's,
right.
Yeah.
These properties, like you said, are looking at getting what I consider almost an unnatural population.
100%. I agree.
So you're looking at 2-3 birds per acre. When we consider a huntable population, a bird per 5 acres,
mm-hmm.
that's a huge difference.
Yeah.
Now, you're pretty hardcore if you're hunting a bird per 5 acres. A more suitable hunting is, you know, a bird per 2 acres. It's a more comfortable, more entertaining, I guess, hunting.
Mm-hmm.
But you're still a bird per 2 acres versus 2 birds per acre is a huge change. And most people don't need that level of population. That's higher than what we saw in the 80s in those high population When people start thinking back into the 80s and the 70s when we had really good populations.
But think about what the landscape was like.
Yeah.
You know, when people are like, oh, nothing's changed. It has changed.
Yeah.
Like your neighbor's houses, all the sheds that are up, you know, the way people have changed the landscape.
The clean farming.
We don't have the connectivity anymore like you used to.
Right.
Clean farming, yes.
And the way we plant trees like row crops and we don't prescribe burn. And so these are all reasons for the decline and things that on a landscape level, we're really not going to make a huge change so that we won't see those in the statewide. You're not going to see bob white numbers back to where they were in the 80s. But within regional areas and with certain populations, you can have really good huntable populations.
Yeah, for sure. Especially with some of the public lands that abut private lands that are dedicated to quail, you know, wild birds.
Yeah.
You can still get really, really good numbers.
Yeah. So it's all landscape context. It's also looking at what are your goals, that landowner's goals. Not everybody's the same. Some people just want to hear bob whites again.
Right.
That's a really easy one to do. Even if you want to hunt birds, depending on where you are in the state, not really that hard of a deal to have a huntable population if you do the management.
Given your acreage and what's around you.
Right. Yeah. So there's a lot of things that come in, but let's assume, I guess we'll start with, if you have a property in the coastal plain of Georgia and you have 200 acres, still a doable management to have a huntable population. You're not going to have a crazy number of coveys, I mean, because we're considering a home range of a covey, 20 to 40 acres, you know, depending on what your habitat is. So, you know, you could have several coveys.
It's probably enough to keep your dogs interested.
Yeah.
And maybe shoot a bird.
Right. You're not going to have a business selling hunts.
And that's what we have at our place. And we are lit up with birds calling. I hear them all the time to the point where I take it for granted.
Yep.
So that's definitely doable.
Yeah. So we have 35 acres. So technically I should have a covey. But last year we had three coveys that were utilized in the property. But it's because of what's around us and the amount of habitat that's there and the cover. Because we were in an early stage of, you know, our longleaf planting, which is ideal bob white habitat. And we were just, you know, we were burning and doing the things that needed to be done. So bob whites were coming in from the other areas and using that kind of periphery. So that's not always going to happen. Again, it's that landscape context, again, on who's around you. If you're surrounded by, you know, really large agricultural fields or really heavy pine plantations around you, then it's going to be hard at those lower acreages.
Yeah, and you have to have reasonable expectations,
yes,
too. And that's the biggest thing when we're working with people is evaluating what you have, what is realistic, mm-hmm, the time you have, the help you have, the equipment you have. Like, all those factors play in to what you're going to be able to do on your property at a basic level.
Right.
And then you can add in those other things to tweak it, maybe make it a little bit, get more.
Yeah. So let's start with, you know, we're going to assume you have a decent amount of property for the landscape that you're in and you have some resources. So what does it take to manage for bob whites? What's needed? And so if you have pines, the first thing that I'm going to look at is what is the density of your pines? Because we're looking at putting sunlight on the ground. We'll utilize things like basal area. And to define basal area for those who may not know, it's basically if you went and cut all your pine trees off at about chest height and you measured the square inches that are covered by those stems, that's your basal area. And so it's going to vary depending on the number of trees you have and how big those trees are. So if we were looking at basal area, which is something the timber, the loggers utilize when they're managing that, we're looking at somewhere between, oh, about a 35 to a 60, 65 square foot of basal area.
Yeah, it's pretty low.
Yeah. And what we're looking at there is the sunlight, as I mentioned. So if you were to stand in that pine stand at noon, you want to see about 60% of that stand in daylight because plants need sunlight to grow. And you're wanting plants on the ground because a pine straw plantation does not do you any good.
No, it's a what we call an ecological sink.
Yeah.
Does nothing. It's just another crop.
Right. And nothing eats pine straw, and there's nowhere in that for bob white to hide, and nothing for them to eat. So if you've got just a monoculture of pines with pine straw underneath it, you're not going to have wildlife in general. So thinning, first thing, and What you take that basal area down to is going to be dependent upon your goals as a landowner. If you need or want more timber revenue and you're managing for timber, you can push it towards those upper ends, just knowing that you're going to not have as high a population of bobwhites as you would if you took it to that lower level. So again, it's that balance. What are your goals and being realistic? And when you're thinking about that thinning too, is what species of pine you have. You can carry a few more longleaf per acre than you can carry of your other southern pines, your loblolly and your slash, because of the way their crowns are.
Yeah, and you need to think about what are your goals with those trees, because quail don't need a tree.
Right.
They're important on the landscape to help carry fire.
Right.
Which is why a lot of places, you know, will keep it, and they're beautiful and so for aesthetics, but you know, you need to think about what you're doing with them. And these days, if you don't have a lot of acreage, your trees aren't, you're going to have a tough time getting them thinned anyways.
Right.
You know, so you're not going to be making a lot of money off of a small acreage pine stand.
Right.
That's the reality.
Yeah, to even get a logger to look at it, really, you need about 40 acres.
Yep.
That's a good point, is what are your goals and be realistic on what you're going to be able to do with it. The next thing that and you kind of touched on was, you know, we're using pines really for carrying fire. So when you're getting to those lower basal areas, you need to really consider what's your ground cover like.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you have really nothing, no grasses, no grass component in that understory, if you take it down to a 35 square foot basal area, you've got so much gap between those trees that you can't carry that fire in between that needle cast.
Right, yeah.
So you may want to carry a little bit higher basal area if you don't have a good ground cover component, or you're going to have to come in and plant some grasses. And then let's manage those pines. Burning. That's a pretty important quail and longleaf pine ecosystems, which was dominant down here, evolved with fire.
That's right. Yep.
So we have to have that fire, and we burned regularly, frequently on a 1 to 2 year burn cycle, 1 to 3 on the top end probably, and patchy burns at that time.
That's the key, is patchy burns. You know, the people that I see burning every year, black to black, have terrible ground cover. Like, they don't hardly have a grass component at all. Never mind, you know, forbs or anything either. There's not much there. And I see that a lot on places that trial, and that's fine. You know, that's their goal. They need to see the dogs, and that's what they want to do. But, yeah, you need to space out that and let it grow. It's going to look messy, and it's okay. Like, you know, you can make some lanes out there if you want to, but the yearly burn on a lot of places that we go to is probably way too much.
Yeah.
You know, they're not letting the ground cover establish.
Yeah. And what I see too on some of these places that burn on an annual cycle is you don't have a fuel buildup.
Right.
And so you can't get the fire hot enough to then kill back the oaks and volunteer pines and things that are come in. So the next thing you know, you've got a wall of vegetation, of woody vegetation, that you're going to have to do some sort of mechanical.
You're going to be really
unhappy with. Right.
Yep, especially if for some reason you have a wet winter.
Oh, yeah.
Like we're having, and you can't get rid of it, it's not going
to
be pretty.
Yeah. So we try to block up, as we had to say, checkerboard your landscape, your pines, into, you know, I say 20 to 50 acre blocks. You can go larger depending on the layout and your ability to be able to burn. You can go smaller. I just don't like real small, those 5-10 acre burns, because I don't think you really get the intensity of the fire in those really small areas. But if you need to, that's fine too. But you want that to where you have a burned area next to an unburned area that gives your quail an opportunity to move into another area that's got cover still. So you're protecting them from predation and giving them a place to go. When you get into those large acreages, you know, that 100 acres, depending on, especially if it's a square 100 acre block, you've burned up a couple of home ranges for quail, so they have nowhere to go.
Mm-hmm.
And we're seeing, too, that turkeys and deer, all of these species do not like these several hundred acre burns, because they can't utilize that. They don't want to be in the middle of a black area either. So it's good for all your wildlife to do checkerboarded small blocks of burning on every other year. So you're burning about half of the property every year, and then you're switching that.
And, you know, those blocks are a lot more manageable for the,
right,
you know, general landowner that doesn't have 20 people out helping them burn.
Right.
You know, I like being able to break things up, because if I don't get to it, well, you know, I can get to it later. or it's not, does it hurt me as bad if I miss half of the season for some reason, half the property's still in decent shape, and I'll catch up with the other one the next year. So I don't have to, I won't skip it next year. I'll get it done.
Right.
And then I'll get back on course.
Right.
It's a lot easier to deal with it that way.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, if you only have a few hours, you can go out and light something up. You're not waiting to try and get all the way across a several hundred acre burn.
Right.
I can burn it in a few hours and be done with it. So it's definitely dependent upon the landowner and what's manageable for them and what they're comfortable with. Mm-hmm. And if you establish permanent fire breaks, then it's there, it's set. You're not having to worry about where your fire breaks are going to go and what have you burned. Make you a map. Keep note of what I burned. This one this year, this one the next year. Keeping records is just makes your life so much easier, and it's not that hard to do.
No, and you can seasonally burn plant that stuff with different things.
Right.
Allows you so much flexibility on your property to be able to mess around with stuff.
Roads can be fire breaks. You know, utilize, I see so many people, they'll put a fire break around their wet areas. There's no reason to do that. If you've got a wet drain in there, that's your fire break.
Yeah. Please don't mess up next to wet areas.
Yeah.
You don't need to.
Let that fire go into it a little ways. That's another thing that is needed is we call feathering those edges. That hard edge is predator habitat. It's not good for wildlife, especially quail.
It's hard for animals to navigate, especially young animals.
Yep.
Can't get up and around over that stuff.
So we don't want those hard edges. Let it go into it. It doesn't hurt your hardwoods to burn into those.
No, and shoot, the shadow cast is going to stop it from going in most of the time anyways.
Yep.
Unless it's super, super dry. Now, we're not talking about when it's like a super dry bog situation or something.
Yep. You know. But even some of those bogs and things need to be burned periodically.
Absolutely, yep.
So, you know, occasionally every 5 to 8 years, roll a fire through them if you have a dry day.
Yep.
Just know that you got to have something on the side of them that year to stop it.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely burn into those drains. Timing of burns, that was the other thing. A lot of people will ask, well, do I burn during dormant season, which is your winter months, which is when most people are comfortable or more familiar with burning, or do I burn during growing season? I like to kind of mix it up.
Mm-hmm.
Burn some of the area during dormant season, burn some of it during growing season, flip those stands in a couple of years and burn them at different times, because the plant response you get is going to vary depending on what time of year you burn. You're going to get better control of your hardwoods if you burn during growing season, and you're also going to see some of your grasses, like wiregrass, are only going to seed if you burn them during that growing season.
Right.
So mix it up.
And it provides different foods
throughout
the year also, and more foods throughout the year.
Right. Your legumes, those things like that dormant season burned, you're going to see some of that come back in. So put that diversity across the landscape. If you have a stand that's got hardwood issues coming in, go ahead and hit it growing season.
Mm-hmm.
And that should save you some herbicide and mechanical treatments that you may have to do. All right, so that's, I think, pretty much most of your management within a pine stand is burning and thinning, making sure you control that hardwood invasion in those stands so that you don't lose your sunlight.
Well, and that's what people, I think, say nothing's changed, is because they just see that hardwood component. It's staying low to the ground, so you're not thinking that it's done much, but have you actually walked in and imagined a bird in that and then looked around and realized there's no food here because, again, the shadows that are under there, it's not, that needs to go.
Right.
And that's my biggest thing when I hear that. It almost always has to do with hardwoods, the young hardwoods just dominating everywhere.
Or
pine.
Yeah. Invasives, something has come in, or like the stand I was talking about where we're not finding the quail this year, is the grasses have just become really dense. It looks like great habitat. They've done the same thing, but it's been too many years.
How are you going to break those? How would you break that grass up? Are you going to disc it or fire?
I would first try fire at a different time of the year to hopefully promote more of the forb component in that. If that didn't work, then that would be something you'd probably have to run a disc through to bust up some of that. But hopefully fire will be able to control some of that regrowth if you change that timing. And then it all depends on the site, the soils. So there's not a set, you've got to do this on your place. Timing of it's going to change depending on where you are in the state. Try a little bit, If it doesn't work, change that timing up, change a little bit something up, work with, a biologist or someone who can help you kind of figure out what's going on if you're not getting the responses that you want. So quail, we mentioned, don't need a tree. They're what we, an open shrubland species. We utilize the trees for fire and aesthetics, as Jess mentioned. So the big component is openings and brood fields or fallow field management, whatever you want to call it. But it's areas where you don't have trees, and bobwhites utilize that because you see a lot of nice forb vegetation or maybe even some mix of grasses and forbs that come in. Those little broods, when they hatch off, they take them into these areas because they have good overhead cover, but that open ground space underneath, and they can get in there and they can forage for bugs and be really happy until they're able to fly. You don't have to worry about predators coming in as much because, well, we mentioned that hard edge. Predators like to run a line. They'll run that line. And so if you're in a big open field, that makes it a lot harder for predators to really find you. So you want something that's, about 2 to 5 acres in size is an ideal for a brood field. But you can utilize, like you had already said, those fire breaks, linear strips, smaller areas, anything that's an opening, you can definitely utilize those. You just want about, I don't know, what is it, like 20 to 40%, or no, it's about 15 to 40%, I think, is what you want on the amount of openings you have across your acreage.
It just depends what you have on the
Right.
rest of it. You might not have to manipulate very much of it because you might have some natural openings.
Right.
It's always good to pair up with a biologist or someone that can kind of get that view for you.
Yeah, if you've got a really low basal area in the stands, you probably don't need as much for your openings. Utilize those logging decks, all of those open areas, the food plots, all of that, fire breaks. Utilize those areas, and you're going to treat them very similar. You're either going to go in and burn them on an annual basis if you have the grasses, or you disc them. So you want that disturbance because we're setting back succession. Discing them at the right time of the year is what's critical, though. That October, late October to the first part of February, depending on when warm up starts. Discing during that time, that winter months, is when you want to do that disturbance so that you get what we call the good weeds.
Keep your eyes open too after you've harvested. Some of the times those logging decks, those are really good openings for you.
Yeah, and if you can burn through them at the first year, their disturbance is there, and then wait a year or so and then come back in and burn those if you can, because you're gonna have the stumps, so it's gonna be hard to disc them, but eventually they'll break up and you can utilize those as well. But disc or just do some sort of disturbance in about a third or all of them, depending on your management goals. There's no set recipe again for brood field management, but do some sort of management during the winter months at least once every 3 years. And the reason we say that is, that first year following disturbance, it's going to be predominantly your forbs, which are good bugging cover. The second year, you're going to start seeing more of your grasses, which is your nesting cover, because they want that second year growth on those bunch grasses for that nesting material. And then if you've got a third year, you're going to start seeing more of your shrub component. So that's your escape cover, your loafing cover. Coming in there. So some people will split their fields up into thirds and disc a third every year so that you kind of get that succession of plant like all across there. So you got a little bit of everything within a small area, which is great for quail because she can nest in an area, they hatch, they walk over to a brood area. If they need escape cover, it's right there. So you want everything in a small area. If you don't have good native plants coming back in, which in some places you don't because of the ag history or whatever it is, then you can plant stuff. Small grains are perfectly fine.
Yeah, we always want to see what comes up first, though. If you have the patience
Yeah.
to do it, it's good to wait and see what's naturally going to come up, because I've always been it's so shocking to see what still comes back up, even after a history of pretty aggressive, farming or whatever was happening there, and to see what still comes up. It's impressive.
We're talking about, being bobwhites on a budget. You don't have to plant anything.
Exactly, which is why when we're writing plans, sticker shock when you start putting some of those seed mixes together.
Yeah.
Now, there are NGOs that have seed mixes, and they've they've done their best to get the best prices and to shop around. That's the key thing. But yeah, it can be pricey. Just do what's free.
Yeah.
At first.
Even if you're buying just millet or sorghum and plain stuff, and some people just want to, they feel like they need to do something, and that's fine if that's what you want to do. But leave it standing. Don't go mowing it down. Mm-hmm. Let it stand throughout the whole year until you're ready to plant again, because you want that cover in there. If you want to mow it high to knock the seed down, especially with like a millet where the seed doesn't really fall, or sorghum where it doesn't fall real well, raise that mower up. You want at least 6 to 8 inches of height for that cover. And then just mow just it and scatter that seed down.
I think that's the thing. You know, I've heard some people try to say quail management is rocket science. It's really not. Mm-mm. And it's just having the openings, and sometimes the less you do is better.
Right.
And yes, we have the tendency to do it because we've been trained that you have to be doing something or it's not going to work. Like mowing. Put the dang mowers away. We don't need to be mowing. We don't need to have these ridiculous lawns that we've created. In fact, I have one landowner that has stopped with his lawn, has, you know, some stuff for snakes away from the house or whatever, but he has birds in his front yard now.
Yeah.
Because he's let it grow. The, you know, bunch grasses have come up. He's got beautiful flowers out there that have just naturally come up in his front yard. And birds right there. He could, his dog's pointing off the porch. Less is sometimes more.
Yeah. Mother Nature knows what to do.
Yeah.
We just have to let her do it.
It's just so hard to get people to stop it.
Yeah.
I'm going to come grab all your spark plugs and all your tractors.
This goes back to our mowing.
Our mowing.
Episode. Yeah. So, yes, that'll save you some money.
Back in May.
Yeah. Don't mow. Save that fuel. Sometimes mowing can be useful. If you need to mow down some hardwood stems that just aren't killed by the fire, you need to knock them back. That's fine. If you want to mow some lanes.
Right, but you're in a restoration phase at that point.
Right.
That's fine. I'm talking about when you're in your maintenance.
Mow, everything. Gotta just be pretty.
Like fire.
Right.
You know, people are like, you're just a pyro. Yes, that's not wrong. But it is a great tool. It's a cheap tool.
Right.
And it's a safe tool when you have learned how to do it, and there's plenty of resources out there to get help.
Right. I use a whole lot less fuel setting fire than I would running a mower across the property.
Yeah.
And mowing on a regular basis creates thatch buildup, which, one, suppresses the growth of some of your plants, and two, quail can't move through it very well, and they can't find the seeds and things that fall through it because they're not good scratchers.
Yeah. And tell me about dog's feet on mowed ground.
Oh, yeah. All the little stems and sticks. Yeah. I don't like walking through.
No, it hurts me with my boots.
Yeah.
Never mind what the dogs must be stepping on.
So if you want to, you know, maintain you some lanes, your fire breaks, whatever, mowing those. If you're going to mow lanes, don't do that until late October, early November, because there's still broods on the ground, so you don't want to impact those broods. If you are mowing for hardwood management, do that following your fire. So limit that for a lot of different reasons. That'll save you some money as well. So we mentioned, you know, you can do the different things. You can thin your stands. That's going to generate you some revenue. Set fire. Pretty cheap. Easy to do. Make sure you get your permit. You don't have to plant anything. Just lightly disc the soils. And I'm not talking about, when we talk about discing too, that's the other thing is, you don't have to sit there and make this look like an ag field that you're getting ready to plant. Just do a light disking.
Yeah.
Is it Hootie says?
I was just going to say that. One of the land managers says, what?
I just want to tickle it.
Yeah.
Just want to tickle the soil.
Just a little bit.
All right. Yeah. So just a couple of inches, just a light, because you're just busting things up, creating that disturbance that a lot of plants like to see so that they can grow again. So pretty cheap. You don't have to have all these extras or, you know, these big plantations are spending a lot of money on the number of people that they have because of the miles and miles of roads that they're maintaining.
And the demand that is there. It's a business.
It is. Yeah. So they're maintaining roads. They're mowing, flat mowing everything because it makes it look nicer. It's easier for them to walk through. They're going to mow, block everything out, which is not needed. Mm-hmm. And they're going to then come in and do what we call plus practices. To push those populations even further. And that's where I'm going to kind of get into a little more unnatural settings at sometimes. But predator management, which may sometimes be needed, depending on where you are, to kind of give quail a chance to get ahead. You may have to set those predators back. But a lot of these plantations spend a whole lot of money doing predator management.
They do, and it's consistent, and it's year-round. It's not just the, not just during nesting season, which I think a lot of people make the mistake. They're just like, oh, time to set the traps. No, if you're trapping, it's you're trapping.
But you, if you are going to trap, you do need to do it during nesting season and not just during hunting season. Like,
you're doing it throughout the year.
So make sure that you're doing it consistently, not just a day or two here or there whenever you're feeling like it. And then supplemental feeding. They supplemental feed all year round across large acreages. That's expensive. It can provide a buffer for your populations if you hit a drought situation or if you have poor natural foods, then it's probably a good thing. It can benefit you, but you've got to, it takes a while for quail to understand or to learn where that feed is. So it's not something you can stop and start a lot. So,
and there's different methods also. Like, don't throw it, you know, down on the roads.
No.
That just, it's easy to pick off.
I say it's ringing the dinner bell for those predators, especially the hawks.
They have some really cool attachments for the tractor that flings it out.
Yeah.
So I can't remember what it's called right now.
Yeah, the side spreaders.
There we go.
Throw that into the cover. Mm-hmm. So that the birds are in cover when they're eating. You don't have to put a ton of it out. You just kind of do it every, 14 days or whenever you're seeing that food begin. And you shouldn't see a yellow brick road. I wouldn't use corn either way, but small grains. And you just don't want to see a lot of it across the landscape. They also will use feeders sometimes. It takes a while for quail to learn where those feeders are. They need to be in cover as well. Mm-hmm. I have some issues a little bit with some of the feeders. A lot of people really like them, and that's great. But you got to make sure that you've got some sort of good cover for the quail that are coming in to protect from predators, because they'll learn those feeders as well, especially snakes.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I wouldn't go near a feeder there without my snake boots on.
Yeah, yeah. So as you're refilling those feeders, make sure you know that those guys are going to be sitting there waiting, because they've learned all the little mice and everything else that they're utilizing.
Around it just to be safe.
So lots of options, but those are things that they're on top of the habitat. They don't have to be done. You can have a really good quail population without those extra things.
Right. Yeah. Like, all those practices are in really high demand populations where it's a business.
Right.
Or it's a public wildlife management area or something is being done because of the demand on the population.
Right. You've got the one wealthy person who just wants to shoot as many birds as they possibly can. And we see that too. But so you don't have to do that. You can do this on a budget. It doesn't take a whole lot. You don't have to plant a whole bunch of stuff. The only thing I recommend usually for somebody planting is if they just don't have anything showing up after a year or two, give it a little bit of time, patience. Or if you don't have the shrub cover that you're needing, then, you know, get you some plums or wax myrtle or something and put you some little thickets around in some areas so that you have that cover. Work with a biologist. Especially if you've been doing this for a while, you kind of get blinders on.
Oh yeah.
You can't see the things that have changed over time. Again, going back to that, nothing's changed in 50 years. You may not see these little things, and it's like watching a kid grow up. If you see them every day, you don't realize how much they've grown. So have somebody come out and just ride through with you, and maybe they'll give you a few things that you can tweak.
Yeah, it's a fresh set of eyes, that, and it's to encourage you too, because sometimes I went on a field visit last week and the family didn't think they were making any progress. And, man, the place was looking phenomenal. And I could not believe it. Because I was out there with the grandfather. I don't want to age myself. But at this point, it was probably 15 years ago.
Yeah.
And just, yeah. So also to get that encouragement that you're doing something right, then we can tweak it if necessary. Often the thing that I miss all the time are invasives, because I just become blind to them on my own place.
Right.
Because I'm trying to avoid it. Facing them, but that's something that, like, new eyes can just see things.
And that's, I'm glad you brought up invasives, because I wanted to mention that before we wrapped up, was that's the only thing I really would put money into is controlling invasives.
For sure.
That's your big money, is that herbicide.
And there's
a
ton of programs.
Yep. Yeah, and you can get assistance with that, so it doesn't have to cost you. You get assistance with burning and everything, so don't let the finances hold you back from doing this. Don't think that you have to have millions of dollars to do it.
No.
And, even if you have a small property, start doing the management on your property and
get
your neighbors. engaged. A lot of times what we see is if the neighbors see that, oh, wow, that looks great, they'll start doing the same thing. Or
That's what we're having to do for timber thinning now. You know, whenever we see the log trucks on our road, we're flagging them down saying, hey, can you pull some of our trees off? Because when you're in small acreages, that's the only way to get stuff done sometimes. And partnering with your neighbors, you can get your burns done more safely, help each other out.
Yep.
You know, and sometimes vendors, if they can hit two of you in a week, it's
close
cheaper. Yes, because they can get it just wiped out right then.
Yeah, and as you get to know those loggers, they know. And so, like, we had thinned ours way down and just had some small spots that I had left, wanted to come back at some point, but I knew I was going to have to tie in. But he knew I was doing that, so when he was back out in our area, he said, hey, you want us to come in and take these? It's good to get to know those loggers in your area, those consultants, and they can help tie in because they're like, it benefits them. Hey, I'm just across the road. You want me to come in and do this? Or, hey, while you're there, take this for me.
Yeah, and the local foresters, you know, they'll help you out and hopefully connect people together.
Yep. All right, so hopefully you understand what quail habitat needs to look like and that you can do this on a budget. It doesn't have to be anything overly expensive. Simple is better sometimes.
Yes.
Let nature do what she needs to do. The only thing we really need to help her with is the fire, because it just doesn't happen that way anymore because of all the development. So we need to put some fire on the ground for her and let her let everything grow. Pray for good weather.
Yeah, sure.
All right, anything else?
No, I think we've touched on a lot of basics and phone a biologist or a forester if you need more.
All right, until next time, we appreciate it, and like, subscribe, follow, comment, whatever you need to do on whatever platform you're on, and share it with some friends.
Let us know you're out there.
Yeah, we appreciate it. Thank you.